On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And coming up today, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation on the sale of Rushy Lagoon.
This is not a short-term land flip project. This is long-term investment in local jobs, in local environment, and for the benefit of all Australians.
And the global demand for lamb, extraordinary, especially in America.
Lamb is having a moment. It's a very small consumed item in America. It's half a kilo per person. It is kind of a new wave of demand. It's a new luxury item. It's similar to Wagyu beef.
Yes, the Americans falling in love with lamb as we take you to the LAMEX conference today to find out more about the global demand, not only for lamb, but also for beef. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Thursday, where we also have reaction to the approval for the sale of Rushy Lagoon, Tasmania's largest farm, to a company which has plans to convert the farm mainly to a plantation forest and move away from dairy and beef. You might have some thoughts on that issue and be part of the discussion via that text line 0438 922 936. We will check the latest on the weather in around 15 minutes from now and the latest testing for the potato mop-top virus in three mainland states. What was the result? All coming up on a busy Thursday, 0438 922 936, our text line number. Well, first up, the state's peak farming body has slammed the federal government's decision to approve the sale of Tasmania's largest farm to a UK forestry investor. The government-funded Clean Energy Finance Corporation has joined forces with Gresham House and British Aviva investors to pay $143 million for Rushy Lagoon. TasFarmers CEO Nathan Kalman says he's extremely disappointed on behalf of the agriculture sector and the northeast community.
You know, it really does feel like it's been sold out and not consulted with as part of this announced sale today. I think, you know, we have to think about what's in the nation and region's interest. And throughout this process, we've been really, really concerned that the local agricultural industry, the local government and the local community haven't been consulted at all around this sale. And we've called for that repeatedly.
And they're saying it'll create 190 jobs. That must be a great news for the region.
You know, we deal, I think, all the time with claims like that, and that's 190 jobs over the life of the project, not 190 new jobs within the region. I think what we need to clearly understand is, you know, how many new jobs will this project create? Because compared to the existing use of the land, we think that it will be significantly less.
And in terms of cattle and sheep, have you heard if they will be kept or if they will be scrapped?
Look, our understanding at this stage is that the primary focus of the land moving forward will be a conversion to forestry. Whilst we acknowledge that that may generate more jobs during key activities like planting, they're probably not going to be ongoing jobs in the region. And, you know, compared to existing uses in dairy and agriculture, you know, that is a huge loss for the region.
In terms of jobs, you know, are we maybe losing more jobs than we're gaining?
I think that is what we're really, really concerned about. The Northeast has many pressures at the moment in terms of jobs for that regional community, particularly out in the far northeast. I think what we're really worried about here is that we're going to be losing some seriously productive agricultural land that is ideally suited for dairying, ideally suited for red meat production, and not ideally suited at all for plantation forestry. It's a very windy location, whereas we know that that rainfall and that soil type is ideally suited to dairying. We know that the current operation of the property isn't using a high input, high output model. In fact, it's using a low input, low output model of production. And we think that with the right buyer, the right local buyer, what we actually would have seen is that ground become far more productive and employ far more people for the benefit of the region. So I think land sales of this size obviously take some time, and the Foreign Investment Review Board process should have ensured that local buyers were given the same opportunity to put offers to market, put offers to the vendor that were acceptable. And, you know, we are aware actually that not only did that not occur, but that in the past months, there were local buyers within Tasmania willing to match the offers that were ultimately accepted by the vendor. And we think that that is a big lost opportunity.
We've just been chatting to the Dorset mayor. He says this could be the tip of an iceberg. Could this set a dangerous precedent?
I think it definitely could set a very dangerous precedent. And, you know, at a time where the state government is trying to grow with industry, the farm gate value to $10 billion by 2050, we have to look at how we maximise the productive gains from every inch of agricultural land, and locking huge areas of productive farmland up for fibre for 25 plus years clearly isn't the right answer for this land. And I think it's a massive missed opportunity that, you know, market investment has created. Rushy Lagoon and its location was very important because there were three dairy farms operating on that property. On the way to that farm, the B double milk tanker would have picked up from multiple other milk farms. Without dairying occurring in that location, it then makes it less profitable for those pickups to occur. The livestock produced on that property for fattening at other properties and then slaughtering in Tasmania for red meat production, you know, then creates another gap within our supply chain, and, you know, that impact will be felt by the industry. It definitely puts the system under pressure because that land area will no longer be used for red meat production. It will be used for plantation forestry, and that, you know, reduces the land mass available for cattle production in Tasmania.
And where's you next?
Look, I think the next step, you know, really is what Tasfarmers has been calling for the last 12 months. We need in-depth consultation between the proposed purchaser and the community to actually understand what this means.
Nathan Kalman, CEO of Tasfarmers, speaking there to Kelsey Reid about the sale of Rushy Lagoon. Well, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation will be contributing $69 million to the acquisition. That's almost half of the overall purchase price of the property, and half of the farm will be planted to pine trees. The CEFC's head of natural capital, He Chung Sung, explains how 190 jobs will be created over the life of the project, which is about 25 years.
So the jobs will be created through the life cycle of this project. So the project is plantation forestry. It has grazing, sustainable grazing activities. It will also have some ecological restoration activities. So over the life cycle of this project, we will create tenfold the number of jobs that we currently have on that farmland. And so, you know, there's a lot of activity up front. There's, you know, periodic activity during the growth phase of the trees, and whilst that's happening, there'll be activity for the grazing activities on the land. So, and then there'll be obviously ramp up of staffing towards the back end of the project. But let's be clear that jobs over the long term is what is fantastic about this project. This is not a short term land flip project. This is long term investment in local jobs, in local environment, and for the benefit of all Australians.
How many hectares of Rushy Lagoon will be planted to pines? I think you mentioned half of the property, so what does that work out to be?
Yeah, so approximately between 9 and 10,000 hectares will be planted with radiator pine trees.
And do you have a specific site in mind?
There is an ecological survey that's been done to work out where is the best for plantation forestry project, where is it best to maintain the remnant vegetation for grazing activities to continue, how do we restore the wetlands that are actually rely on, you know, strong environmental projects to ensure the native flora and fauna is, you know, not threatened. And so there are a myriad of activities that are going to happen across this very diverse landscape. And as a result, it requires a lot of investment, requires capital. And over the several years of this farmland being held by a private individual, we have seen the, you know, land degrading further because it requires investment. That's why this project is so exciting. We can bring that capital and bring in capital from institutional, long-dated, aligned investors.
Is Gresham open to the idea of potentially leasing out part of the farm to livestock grazing at all?
I think that's a question perhaps for them, but as they are the investment managers of this platform. But we would be always open to approaches around leasing activities for cattle. In fact, you know, the current owner has in the past leased land to operators. So it's a quite a common practice. So we're not excluding any activities per se, where we are assessing every activity on its merits.
There's been a lot of public and political criticism of the CEFC's involvement prior to the application being approved. Do you think taxpayer money should be invested in a foreign company when there are other players that were bidding, other Australian players that were bidding for this property?
Perhaps I would state it like this. This isn't a story about local ownership versus foreign ownership or agriculture versus forestry. This is where we get the right capital partners to invest in landscapes that are for the benefit of not only that region but for Australia. And in this case, the current property is owned by, 100% owned by a foreigner. And so with this transaction, the CEFC is acquiring almost half the asset back in Australian hands. This is a large sum of capital that's needed to bring back to life this asset. And so we are really excited to be working with long-dated institutional investors to be able to invest in the local community, the local landscape, you know, to better Australia's future. Australia is a net importer of construction timber. And so with this project, we will be able to supply onshore Australian grown, you know, Australian made timber logs into the Australian market. I think that's really, really important.
But having said that, if we can just go back, Stephen Scala is the chair of the CEFC. He's also a director of the Foreign Investment Review Board. Is there a perceived or clear conflict of interest there? Was he removed from those meetings or communications?
Larissa, I can't talk to FIRB's process. That is a question for FIRB. But what I can say is that we, along with the other investors, complied with the application process like we do in many transactions. It's not unusual. And we, with the other investors and the current owner of this asset, just waited for the approval. In terms of their process and their consideration, that really is something that has to be asked of them. We don't have any visibility there.
So you don't think you have distorted the market in which there were other bidders vying for Rushy Lagoon who weren't receiving taxpayer money to purchase the site?
Larissa, couple of things. There is no concessionality or leg up that we are giving to Gresham or anybody else in this acquisition. This land and the current owner has put it up for sale on and off in the market since 2018. And they have canvassed many buyers, and many buyers have had the opportunity to participate in this process. The reason why that they haven't been successful is probably because this land is not, you know, it is not suitable for high agriculture production. You know, for the process around buying this land, you know, the valuation, that is something that we did with utmost good faith with the other investors. And quite frankly, there's been a lot of opportunity for other market players to participate.
Well, how much is the CFC investing in this?
The platform is committing $142 million to the establishment of this project, and the CEFC is contributing $69 million. That is disclosed. We can now talk about that. This capital is not just to buy the land. It is to invest in the trees, the soil work, the labour. You know, there's a whole bunch of costs associated with upgrading the rundown infrastructure on this farm. The capital provided will be invested to address all of those needs.
Carbon credits or offsets are part of this package as well?
Yeah, what the carbon credits do under the plantation methodology under the ACCU scheme, which is a well-established high integrity method, is that it will offer upfront revenue for this project that we can then reinvest on the land. So the proceeds of those credits will be reinvested in the land, so we're not topping up constantly equity that's needed to continually rehabilitate this landscape.
That's Heechung Sung, Executive Director and Head of Natural Capital at the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, talking to Larissa Smith about their investment in the Rushi Lagoon sale. We'll have some text line messages shortly, but let's check the latest on the weather. First up with Daniel Sherwin-Simpson from the Bureau. G'day, Daniel.
G'day, Tony.
A little bit of rain somewhere.
Yeah, there's a few spots up north, not a whole lot in it, but in the last 6 hours we've seen 1.4 millimetres at Flinders Island Airport, 1.2 at Smithton Aerodrome, and a few little spots under a millimetre in the northeast. Not looking at a whole bunch of rainfall up there. We could still see a few more spots broadly about the north, but it's going to be, you know, 1 or 2 millimetres at most for any places today. Not particularly widespread. It's going to be, you know, those kinds of hit or miss showers. And as we move into tomorrow, look, similar, we might still see a few errant showers hanging around the north through the morning, but By tomorrow afternoon, it's pretty much looking mostly dry across large parts of the state. Still in this real settled weather pattern. Not going to see much change in the weather tomorrow. We'll just quickly cover off that we are still expecting that our road weather alert to stick around for tomorrow morning. It'll just be for the Central Plateau, Midlands and Upper Derwent Valley, just due to some possible icy roads with still frosty temperatures through those districts tomorrow. But look, generally, we are on the slight warming trend, just adding on a degree or two to what we see through the morning. So, look, still cold and wintry, but not as frosty as it has been. Currently, we're sitting around 12.8 degrees at Launceston, 10.8 at Hobart. We won't see too much warming for the rest of today. Generally, expecting large parts of the state to range between sort of the 9 to about 13 degree range or so, Tony.
Now, will the weather change when we hit the weekend?
Yeah, so we are going to see things change a bit as we move into the weekend. That's when we're going to see some more substantial showers develop over the north coast at first. Those will start to pick up through probably very, very late Friday. We could see some more showers developing, but it'll really be through Saturday that we'll see things become a bit more substantial. Not going to be as wet as the rainfall that we saw last week, but across that north coast on Saturday, I think broadly 5 to 20 millimetres, maybe seeing some, you know, 25 isolated totals through parts of the western tiers. I think most people up north will get a bit of a soak on Saturday, and then as we move into Sunday with that front rolling through, we get a pretty fresh belt of westerlies, so we're going to see plenty of showers and rain over the west coast. I'd say your wettest day still looking like that Monday for your west coast, so places like Strawn, Strathgord, and they might see 20, 30 mils or so, and then as you head up to, you know, your peaks up there somewhere like Mount Reid, not out of the question that we see a 40 or 50 mil at that location over sort of Sunday to Tuesday. Could start to nudge 80 mils in some places at the higher end of things. I think most places will be looking more around the 40 mils for a three-day total. So, yeah, a bit of wet weather coming up with that front over the weekend and into early next week. It's going to bring a bit of snowfall about some of the southern peaks, maybe a light dusting up at Ben Lomond, but nothing too significant. Generally typical Tassie rainfall this time of year. As you move further east, you're going to get less. So, you know, someone out at St. Helens or like Friendly Beaches, they might only see a millimetre or two out of these fronts coming through on the weekend and early next week, Tony.
Right now, warnings, what have we got?
Yeah, so I mentioned that road weather alert that's still out for the Central Plateau, Midlands and Upper Derwent Valley. So those icy roads would have cleared out for today, but this is more a warning in place to warn for tomorrow morning when things get icy again overnight. We do have a marine wind warning out for the southwest and the central west coast, but that's for tomorrow again. Out on the coastal waters, we aren't seeing things too bad at the moment. Generally across the northern coasts, we're in a north to northeasterly 10 to 15 knots. And then as you look through other coastal waters, those winds tend more north to northwesterly and get her up around to 15 to 20 knots. As we move into tomorrow, most of your winds will fall into that north to northwesterly pattern, and we will see things pick up a little bit more off the west coast as we move into the evening. So 20 to 30 knots offshore in the evening across the west coast, but otherwise relatively settled. Swells aren't going to change a whole lot from what they've been doing over the past couple of days, and they won't change too much tomorrow either. Today we're looking at in the west and south, a southwesterly swell of 2.5 to 3.5 metres. In the north, we're looking westerlies around 1 metre, and in the east, we're looking at a south to southwesterly swell of 1 to 2 metres with a secondary easterly swell around 1 metre. So not too bad out on the waters, but yeah, those winds will pick up a bit on the west coast as we move into tomorrow and the weekend.
Good on you, Daniel. Thank you for that.
Thanks, Tony.
No worries. Daniel Sherwin-Simpson from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the Country Hour. On this Thursday afternoon, a couple of texts. Steve, the truck driver. G'day, Steve. Hope you're going well out there on the roads and they're not as slippery as sometimes they are early morning. The issue, this is about Rushy, the issue begins when they stop calling farms farms and instead refer to them as assets and platforms. Thank you, Steve. Cole says, pine trees create very acidic soil condition. Jobs are only one factor when deciding who to sell prime land to. The sooner these land sales are made public before contracts are signed, the better. And Helen says, how many years before they will be ready for harvest? What a disgrace by the federal government. This is the sale of Rushy Lagoon. Well, let's continue our coverage of that sale. Its new owners have indicated that beef cattle will continue to run alongside its planned forestry plantation. Jim Wilson is the chair of Private Forest Tasmania. And he says diversification is fairly common on Tasmanian farms.
Well, the first point to say, Larissa, really is that I'm not here to speak on behalf of the purchaser. My perspective here is as chair of Private Forest Tasmania. And our mandate really is to facilitate growth in the private forest sector. So we're really pleased with this investment, this signal in the future of the Tasmanian forest sector.
There are trees on farms coexisting with livestock right across the state, and that's what the new owners of Rushy Lagoon plan to do. So why do you think people have reacted in such a strong way against what it's proposing?
Yeah, look, this is a highly emotional debate, and I think really it's worth stepping back and thinking about some higher order principles in terms of what drives the Tasmanian economy. Really here we need, Tasmania relies upon a vibrant agricultural sector, but it also relies upon a vibrant forestry sector. And in fact, we need both. We don't need one or the other. And in fact, when you look at the diversity of our land asset in Tasmania, we really need both to leverage the best outcomes for our economy. You know, people often see these landscape changes as permanent changes. The point that I'd really emphasise is that land changes from agriculture to plantations, plantations back to agriculture quite regularly. I drive past properties every day on my way to Launceston that are doing just that. And when you look at the numbers, in fact, over the last 10 years in Tasmania, we've seen 80,000 hectares of hardwood plantations transitioned back to agriculture. So this idea that land is lost forever is really false. There's a flux of land sort of that optimises our landscape all the time.
How do you classify suitable land to grow pine trees or any kind of monoculture when you've got when you want to coexist with, say, a livestock or cropping enterprise? How do you kind of make sure that you're putting trees in the right spot, and in this case, in the far northeast of the state?
Yeah, right trees in the right place. Really, I think it's important that we have an open market here, that in fact we give that flexibility to our landowners to make those decisions based on the enterprise mix that they want to run on their properties. We do in fact have a protection of agricultural land policy in Tasmania. We've had that here since 2009, and that's aimed at protecting our best quality agricultural land, our class 1, 2 and 3 land, from enterprises that aren't traditional agriculture. that includes plantation forestry. You know, I don't know the property in question here intimately, but as I understand it, that's well outside the scope of the of prime agricultural land, so that's not in question here.
But it had been running, you know, up to 55,000 sheep in the past, a couple of decades ago, a couple of thousand dairy cows, and, you know, 8,000 head of cattle. That number's dropped. But so it was once prime property.
Well, it's certainly been a significant agricultural enterprise. How it fits within the definition of prime agricultural land is probably a different interpretation. It's not about the gross livestock capacity of a particular property. It's about the quality of land on a per hectare basis. I take the point that, you know, this is what contributes to the emotion of what's at play here. And what I'd really remind everyone is that we need to sort of step back from this in isolation and think about sort of the Tasmanian landscape and the role that forests and agriculture have in integrating with each other. You know, we see far more land going from plantations back to agriculture than the other way around.
Well, the purchasers of the property have said that it'll create 190 jobs across the life of the project, which would be growing the trees. Where do you see those jobs within that northeast region and the forestry sector broadly?
Yeah, Larissa, so I live in the northeast. I live near Scottsdale. And when you look at the sort of forest, the employment in the forest sector generally, a lot of it is based on supply chain employment rather than on an individual property, because there's sort of a time, a reference point there in terms of when plantations reach those seasonal peaks in employment, when they're being planted and when they're being harvested. But really, from a forest perspective, you know, we've got about 3,000 direct employees in the forest sector in Tasmania, and maybe 5,000 when you add in the indirect employment. You know, when I think about the region that I live in near Scottsdale, there's a lot of people both in the rural community here and the town that rely on employment from our forest sector and not from an individual property. It's really, when you think about employment in the forestry sector, it's hard to isolate it to a particular property. It's really more about the aggregation and what that provides for our economy here.
It's Jim Wilson, Chair of Private Forest Tasmania, speaking to Larissa Smith about the sale of Rushy Lagoon. Don't forget, you can read more online, ABC Rural, on our rural page and our rural Facebook page as well. Larissa Smith has done a terrific story on online at ABC Rural. Still to come on The Country Hour, the results of testing for mop top virus in potatoes from three mainland states. And we'll take you to the LAMEX conference in Adelaide and see what the lamb market is doing and what predictions are for lamb and beef as well. First up, let's check the latest news headlines with Loretta Loberger.
Good afternoon, Tony. Members of the North East community have criticised the sale of the state's biggest farm, Rushy Lagoon, to the UK's largest forestry investor. Yesterday, the 22,000-hectare property was approved for sale by the Foreign Investment Review Board and Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers. Tasmanian authorities say Neil the Seal appears to have left his resting spot near Hobart after spending several weeks there. Southern Ocean and Antarctic ecology expert at the Sydney Institute of Marine Science, Clive McMahon, says it's normal for young elephant seals like Neil to head out to sea after spending a few weeks on land resting. US media is reporting that Iran is desperate to make a deal to end tensions in the region. Axios says President Donald Trump has told reporters aboard Air Force One that Iranian officials called a little while ago asking for renewed US military strikes across the country's south to stop. FIFA President Gianni Infantino is being referred to Olympic ethics investigators for a possible breach of political neutrality after President Trump helped block a World Cup player's ban. Sports and human rights NGO Fair Square lodged the complaint over the decision to allow American striker Fallarin Balogun to play against Belgium despite receiving a red card in his previous match. More news at 1 o'clock.
Live and direct.
Joel Weinberger for Afternoons.
Thump. What was the first beatboxing noise that you mastered?
When I was a kid, I used to always draw and make all the sound effects of what I was drawing. Like...
where do you tend to do it? Is there a place?
For sure, it started off in the shower until I became an adult and was starting to worry about water restrictions.
Afternoons with Joel.
Afternoons.
Weekdays on 936 ABC Hobart.
All that kind of stuff.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yeah, don't forget that text line 0438 922 936. G'day, Trev. Surges Bay. Hope you're doing well there, and congratulations on the Blues win overnight. Yes, I've got my jersey on, looking good in blue at the moment. And commiserations to all you Queensland supporters out there. At Tewkesbury, Dave, every time I look at the government potato research station at Tewkesbury under trees, it makes me spit chips. Pardon the pun. Thank you for that, Dave. Now, talking potatoes, testing has found mainland Australian seed potatoes are free from mop top virus. The virus was first detected in Tasmanian potatoes in July last year. It's been 12 months. And later in Victoria in September. Since then, the Australian Seed Potato Industry Certification Authority, called AusPICA, has been undertaking a comprehensive virus surveillance program in Victoria, South Australia and New South Wales to identify any spread of the mop top virus. AusPICA General Manager and Principal Plant Pathologist Dr. Nigel Crump explains the results.
Yeah, so we've been testing samples from underneath the seed growers' graders. So as they're grading their potatoes for sale, we've been taking undersoil samples, the soil that's collected underneath that grader, and using DNA tests. And we've actually been looking for the mop top virus, and we haven't been able to find it in all of the growers that we've surveyed. So that's across Victoria, South Australia and parts of New South Wales.
So very positive news. Is that what the organisation was expecting to find?
Look, we wanted to make sure that the disease wasn't present, so we're glad that it's a positive outcome in that we haven't found the disease, but also we didn't have any preconception. We wanted to make sure that we had good science to underpin the trade.
So just so we understand, in this testing you found the vector but not the virus, that's correct?
That's right. So in all the samples, I think about 63% of the samples we've tested, we've found the vector, so the spongospora, the fungus, but we haven't found the virus. So what it does show, there's a twofold result here. One, it's good that we know the vector's present, but we haven't found the virus. But the other thing it actually shows, if the virus was to become in, it'd be quickly spread amongst a wide area of Australia's potato production.
So can you explain for our audience that might not be so familiar with the disease why it is such a risk to seed potatoes in Australia?
Look, the mop top disease is actually spread by a fungus called spongospora, which is causes another disease called a powdery scab. The powdery scab causes blemishes on the outside of the tubers, and we have that powdery scab disease present in all parts of Australia. But the virus, the potato mop top virus, causes brown arcs with inside the flesh of the tuber. And it's once we've got it, you've pretty much got it for the rest of your life. So 40-year life cycle or beyond. And it can cause, you know, downgrades in quality of potatoes because people don't want to eat stuff that's got blemishes on them. So even if it costs, you know, a marketable yield decrease of 2%, it probably could cost the industry over $25 million a year in lost production.
So that's quite a significant risk. From what you've found through your testing, does that mean essentially that those potatoes are safe, or is there an ongoing risk that it could spread?
Look, it shows that the disease is not established. And back in July of last year, the disease was first detected in Tasmania, and there was concerns in about how far the disease had spread in Australia. So we needed to make sure that the disease wasn't widespread on mainland Australia. And we did that, again, to protect consumers for making sure they've got access to potatoes, but also for international export markets. There's a number of markets that have mop top as a restriction for trade. And we've got increasing trade going into Indonesia and Thailand and other countries. So we wanted to make sure that we had confidence that this disease wasn't established, and so we'll continue to do the surveillance to make sure that that disease is not here.
Yes, I was going to just ask, so, you know, the testing will continue. There won't really be any change to the work the organisation's doing?
No, at this stage, we're about probably three quarters of the way through of the testing, and we'll continue to do that testing probably into subsequent seasons as well. It's just a responsibility we have to make sure that we have good evidence to support trade restrictions.
And it can be a bit of an expensive process doing all this testing. Would the organisation be looking for any support from the government, or is it just going to be funded by Australia's potato growers?
Look, at this stage, we haven't had any support from government, and it's entirely been funded by the sea growers and the authority itself. We saw that while there was trade barriers, there was no surveillance activities occurring for this particular disease. So we saw it necessary to have that body of evidence to support ongoing trade and the suppression of this disease.
So Australia is not the only country dealing with mop top. How are we comparing to some of those other countries, say our neighbours over in New Zealand, for example?
So, yeah, I think we're taking a very proactive response here. We're trying to be a bit different to other countries. When other countries have found it, such as New Zealand, it was very widespread. And so we've taken an approach to try and establish how far has it and put appropriate restrictions to either slow the spread of the disease down or prevent it from being entering into new areas. So I think we are taking a very proactive response, but we need data such as we're building to understand where is the disease and how do we manage it.
So are you looking for more support from potato farmers? Have they been willing to work with the organisation so far with this testing?
So look, all of our members, we put out a notification to all of our members that we're actually going to do this testing, and there's been overwhelming support for this. I think most of the growers understand the need for good biosecurity, and they also want to make sure that you know, the disease isn't allowed just to walk into the states. So I think everyone's been very supportive about this disease surveillance that we've actually been doing. And that's why I think it's important to tell everyone about the outcomes of it as well. It's not only been positive response in terms of results, it's been positive to see all of industry working together to get this work done.
That's Australian Seed Potato Industry Certification Authority General Manager and Principal Plant Pathologist, Dr. Nigel Crump, speaking with Elsie Adamo about the testing being done for potato mop top virus in three mainland states, South Australia and New South Wales and Victoria, and they have found no indication that the virus is there. The organisation has confirmed no testing was done in Tasmania. A couple of more texts on Rushy Lagoon. Russell says, will the CEFC have an environmental covenant on the northeast property? That'd be good for everyone. Thank you. And Stuart says, hi, Tony. In this NAIDOC week, I wonder whether the Foreign Investment Review Board gave any consideration to First Nations and their ownership and knowledge of such a vast area of land. Thanks for that, Stuart. 0438 922 936, our text line number. We'll take you to LAMEX, the big lamb conference, in just a moment.
Rick Goddard for breakfast.
Let's get to Trump Tower. We'll have it at Primrose Sands.
How many stories are you thinking?
Oh, 50, 60, Prim Vegas.
Mornings with Leon Compton.
The Fragrance Group, they proposed a building that I think was 140 stories.
Into it, I love it.
That was right down on the waterfront.
Elegant, it tall.
For everything Hobart.
Elegant,
beautiful.
It would have dominated the Hobart skyline.
Let's put it at Primrose Sands, the Gold Coast of southern Tasmania.
Rick Goddard from 5:30 and Leon Compton from 8:30. Each weekday from 936 ABC Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, when LAMEX was last held in Adelaide 2 years ago, the lamb prices were pretty dismal. Fast forward to this week, where LAMEX is back on again in Adelaide, it's a very different story. US-based President of Global Agritrends, Brett Stewart, has returned to Australia for the event, having successfully predicted back in 2024 that lamb prices could reach $10 per kilogram. Cassie Huff asked him what he's been observing lately in sheep and lamb global trends.
You know, it's interesting, Cassie. Forecasting is not easy in agriculture, and we always look at the charts and we look back in time and say, oh, of course, we should have seen that coming, or we know this. So myself, my business partner Simon Quilty, who is based here in Australia, we spend all week, every week, we're trying to analyze politics and exchange rates and demand and put supply together and come up with a forecast. It is phenomenal. And in agriculture, we all get pretty good at forecasting supplies. That's what we all do. Demand, no one can forecast demand. And we're in a spot right now where demand is phenomenal. And you know, you mentioned my $10 forecast on lambs. I actually missed it. We're about $11.50 right now on those lambs. But if you miss it on the right side, people are pretty forgiving. And so I didn't over forecast it. But the piece, honestly, 2 years ago that we just did not see is how incredibly good
global demand for lamb would be right now.
Well, that was my next question. What is driving sheep and lamb internationally then?
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is. And most proteins are not interchangeable. We look at pork or poultry or some of those other proteins. But with lamb, one that is very closely related is beef. And beef and lamb demand globally is phenomenal. And like I say, it's hard to explain. I can look in America and tell you what some of the consumer trends are. Lamb is having a moment. It's a very small consumed item in America. It's half a kilo per person.
But and what are we in Australia, about 8 kilos or something like
probably.
That?
Probably. So we're 40 kilos of chicken a year in America. We're half a kilo of lamb. But it is kind of a new wave of demand. It's a new luxury item. It's similar to Wagyu beef. And it's hard to explain how those retail trends shift and consumers shift. But boy, demand for lamb is strong in America and around the world.
In America, part of the demand for beef is the turnoff that was seen in America, given they're such a big player in the beef industry. But as you said, they're not a big player when it comes to production of lamb. So there must be different forces at work then when it comes to demand.
Yeah, and what it really is in America, I guess if you distill it down, there's a huge wave chasing protein. Protein is the new buzzword. So you look at these Gen Z, these young guys, they're pouring protein powder on everything they eat right now. Then you've got the even the elderly, and doctors used to say, well, you have high blood pressure, cholesterol, avoid red meat. They're not saying that anymore. They're saying eat high quality, dense protein. The GLP-1 drugs, the weight loss drugs, a lot of those diets are designed around small amounts, high-quality protein. And so we're in a spot where every generational group in America is chasing high-quality protein at the same time.
You're American. I had some friends come over from Canada a long time ago, and I grew up on a sheep and cattle place. And my mother asked them, is there anything you don't eat? And they said, we eat everything. We just don't eat weird meats like crocodile or kangaroo or lamb or something like that. Mum sort of pulled the lamb roast out of the oven and thought, okay, we're having steaks. It is, as you say, perhaps something that people are not that au fait with in the States. Are you seeing the demand from perhaps more the people who have moved to the States, or is there genuinely the American who has been in America for a long time also looking for meat, for lamb?
Yeah, good question. So we have pockets of real high-density ethnic populations that chase lamb. Middle Easterners, a lot of the different ethnic groups really chase lamb. But think about this, Cassie. I had a friend who went to a wedding recently, and it was kind of a high-shelf, white tablecloth kind of wedding event. And his comment was the two meal options were salmon or lamb. Now, in America, that's pretty unique, right? Like, yeah. I'm saying half a kilo per capita. But at a really nice wedding, your options were salmon or lamb. And I thought, that's interesting.
What is the mutton story then as well? Is that separate to lamb?
Yeah, separate and much less consumption of mutton. You know, if you look at your Australian mutton exports, a lot go to the Middle East, a lot go to a lot of other markets.
And so what sort of long-term trends, you've mentioned some of the long-term trends, but what sort of things do you think you want the lamb producers, sheep and lamb producers, to take away from your presentation today?
So, yeah, you always look at markets and you say, what's different this time? And that's the key question. I think what's different this time is the new demand. Supply will adjust, right? High prices will spur production, and in a couple of years we'll have heavy production again. But I think what changes is with new demand, I think the price lows in the next cycle will be much higher than the lows in the last cycle, supported by beef. And beef is in a completely unique spot where we're seeing rebuild begin in South America, North America, and Australia all at the same time. And so I guess what I'd say is in the next downward cycle, I don't think prices will go as low as they were in the past. I think lamb will be very well supported.
That's US-based President of Global Agri Trends, Brett Stewart, speaking with Cassie Huff at Lamex, which is underway this week in Adelaide. Now, the Future Flock Initiative was put forward as a way to bring the sheep meat and wool industries together in a shared strategic vision. It was launched late last year, and this week at LAMEX, Sheep Producers Australia launched its Future Flock Consultation Report. Angus Hobson is a New South Wales sheep producer who's on the Future Flock Advisory Panel. Cassie Huff asked him to explain this latest step in the process.
I guess it's a snapshot in time, if you like, of what we've heard when we've been consulting with producers, processors, live exporters, agents, etc., all the stakeholders for the sheep industry from around Australia. It's a snapshot in time of what we've heard from them and where we think that might go.
And this is a national approach to the sheep and wool industry. Why do you think it's taken so long to actually get a national approach to what is a very prominent industry, has been such a, probably less prominent than has been in the past? Why has it taken so long, do you think, to get a national strategy?
I think that could be the multi-billion dollar question. look, I think it's fair to say it's a big, diverse industry. It's a very broad bell curve. It's a big church of ideas, if you like. So it's always going to be quite a challenge to not only just engage with that breadth of industry, literally, physically, but also ideologically as well. And so that takes time. But I'd like to think that we've largely touched every corner of Australia's sheep production zones.
And from the consultation you have been doing, what are some of the key themes coming through?
Yeah, not surprisingly, some of these are not necessarily brand new. In fact, more often than not, we're coming up with ideas that have probably been bubbling away for any number of years, but have not possibly not been fully resolved. But the big issues are around confidence in the industry. I'd point out that we're at a point in time where, if you're a sheep producer, I was just looking at indicator prices for June. We are at record or near record indicator prices for mutton, lamb and wool. But still, as Bonnie pointed out earlier today, we have confidence issues in the industry. Volatility remains an issue. I was reminded, even from the context of our own business, it was only a matter of 2 years ago that alongside our kill sheet for lambs, we would get a bill for $10 a skin disposal fee. And how that's changed now. Those skins are now worth $35 to $45. So it's one hell of a turnaround. I guess the other issue coming through is how we have more connectivity through the supply chain. It's one of those things, easier said than done, but in particular making sure we've got timely and transparent market signals coming down through the supply chain.
There are a lot of plans out there. The stuff in the States, the Stats Australia has its industry blueprints. Each of the wool organisations have their blueprints. How are you actually going to, how will Future Flock align with all those different plans that are out there?
It's a good question. It's a big challenge, and we would be the first to admit that landscape, that strategic plan landscape, is pretty busy already from the outset. Where Future Flock's not going to be all things to all people, and nor do I think we should try and imagine it to be. I guess we've got a mapping exercise that we've partly undertaken and we've got to fulfil. What we're looking for, I think, critically, are where the gaps are in terms of existing strategies, whoever they may reside with, and where we can possibly fill those gaps, and possibly, maybe even more importantly, of the plethora of strategies that are out there already, which are the ones that are working, and how do we possibly, through the Future Flock mechanism, how do we help make those strategies work even better? I think it is worth pointing out that this is the first national attempt at a truly combined sheep meat and wool strategy for Australia. So this is very much about a Team Australia. How do we take what is currently a great industry and make it even greater?
There have been concerns raised by some fairly significant stakeholders about concerns that perhaps it's been rushed, that there hasn't been enough opportunity to consult widely enough. Given that people didn't actually even know really what was actually being released here at LAMEX, it's not the final plan, it's just your summary of, well, not just, but it's your summary of your consultation. How do you bring in some of these stakeholders who have been pretty critical of the process so far?
Yeah, look, it's a fair point. I think when you embark on an endeavour like this, there's always going to be elements of why didn't you do it this way? We'd also concede that the timeframes have been pretty tight here. The most important thing that I'd point out at this point is, again, what we've brought to LAMEX today is a snapshot in time. This is not the end of the consultation journey. It was interesting. It was only a matter of 2 or 3 months ago that we actually launched the regional consultation forum in this state of South Australia, and they were fantastic forums. They were well attended, good breadth of input from across the supply chain. I think it's fair to say, as we've gone through this journey, we've recognised, OK, we need to get more feedback from this particular area, and we've probably got enough from that particular area. So we've already got quite a long list of anything from consultation interviews to further engagements with industry that we'll go back to over the course of the next few months as well. But again, I just reiterate, this is a snapshot in time. One consistent theme we had, it didn't matter whether we were consulting in forums in Western Australia or Tasmania or New South Wales or Queensland, that one of the consistent themes was, look, whatever you do, this is a big endeavour, but please don't short-circuit the quality of this document, this framework, in order just to meet a particular deadline.
Will you be taking on some of the feedback, though, from state farming organisations, Sustainable Innovation, any of the groups that do now have feedback on what you release? How will they be incorporated in going forward, given I very much have the impression that they don't feel like they have been brought along with you at this stage?
Yeah, it's a little bit disappointing to hear that, in the sense that we were actively involved with all sheep industry stakeholders, including all the state farm organisations, in pulling together regional forums. We have an open door policy, so we will go back wherever we take feedback, as we have throughout the whole process. It's been generally positive feedback, but one of the most refreshing things I've seen personally is that even where there's been a divergence of opinion, it's been debated maturely, and we've reached a point that's, I guess, arguably the best point for an industry as a whole.
Yeah, New South Wales sheep producer Angus Hobson and the member of the Future Flock Advisory Panel speaking with Cassie Huff at LAMEX in Adelaide. And we'll catch you after midday tomorrow.